All right. Welcome to this On Par edition, the U.S. Open On Par edition with Kieran Clark. Kieran, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm not too bad at all, Anthony. And it's lovely, the longest day of the year here, the official beginning of summer. And the weather's fantastic. Unfortunately, I've got a bit of a sore throat right now, so my voice is kind of waning, but I'll try and keep it going. Obviously, we've just a bit recovered from a quite extraordinary US Open at the weekend there, something that we'll certainly not forget, maybe not for the right reasons, but we'll certainly delve into that coming up. And firstly, I must say, it's just good to be back on the podcast. It's great to be back. And Anthony, well, I can tell you that our really dedicated collection of listeners, the hardcore fans, they've been missing us, so they'll be happy, and I'm happy too.
Have you been getting quite a few DMs on what's been going on? Is that what's going on?
Exactly, I have, and actually I actually passed one DM off the other day and said the podcast is actually coming back, and they said, and they were so happy about it. So, you know, all five of our dedicated listeners, Anthony, are delighted right now.
I was just going to say, how did you get back to all five of those DMs at one time? I mean, that's...
well, when I say five, it's probably more two, but, you know, an even number of two people, I guess. But, you know, we're trying to expand our listenership, I guess.
Well,
you know, they've missed us, but we're back with a bang today, and we've got a lot to talk about.
Well, if one of those DMs wasn't our friend Stuart Armstrong, I'll be quite upset.
Well, you know, Anthony, I was about to mention him because, just as a quick aside here, you know, I work for a website called Golf Shake, and we had a sweepstake on over the weekend there. People could pick a number, and they were linked with a player at the US Open, and if that player won the US Open, they won a prize. Well, I can tell you that Stuart Armstrong's wife had Dustin Johnson in the sweep.
Get out of here.
Well done, the Armstrongs.
And what did the Armstrongs win?
You know what? I have absolutely no idea. Probably some rubbish from somebody's garage, but they've won some goodies, some golf balls, some tees, some who knows what. I have nothing to do with this in particular. It wasn't my idea, but the Armstrongs won. Because actually, if it was my idea, Stuart and his wife would never have won it.
Exactly. You took the line right out of my mouth. Although, if he did get golf balls, that's good because his kids are playing now, so you can never have enough
absolutely.
Golf balls when there are children involved. All right, so let's move on to the U.S. Open. I know, you know, you can say all you want about your lost voice, but I understand you've probably been screaming all night into the wee hours.
Yes, I think that's probably the reason behind it.
At the arrogance and the lack of humility that is the USGA, and
yes.
You've been cursing them for the past 12 hours or so.
I have.
So I understand.
I'm guilty as charged.
You can say all you want about how you don't feel well and you're just getting over a cold, but we all know the reason, because I could hear you in New York on this side of the pond, your disdain and your disgust. I could hear
yeah.
I could hear it from all the way to Long Island. So, I don't even know. You know, I'm quite frankly. Let's start with me.
Yeah.
Being in
where do we start?
I don't even know. Well, I want to start with me, not apologizing, but just want to express my, you know, a little bit of embarrassment that the USGA, the Americans on this side of the pond, just can't seem to get their act together and sort of not make themselves the center of the story. I'm not, listen, the RNA is no innocent. Let's get that,
you know,
they're far from innocent. And, you know, they should have pulled those guys off the golf course in the remote part of the golf course in the Open last year. And that may or may not have cost Spieth a chance at the, you know, he cost him a bogey. I'm not saying that's the bogey, but mm-hmm. we all know that they've made their fair share of mistakes. But having said that, their mistakes are, one, far and fewer between. Number two, they seem to be less spectacular than the USGA's mishaps, if you will. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm just getting tired of talking about the USGA and because that's not what the US Open is about. The US Open is about identifying the best, you know, golfer that in the fashion in which only the, you know, that we've come to know the United States Open. long, tough, whatever. Yes, we've deviated from that in recent years, but we still know that it's going to be par is sort of where we're looking to be, and you know somewhere around even par or over par is where we're going to end up, whether it's plus five, even or minus five, we're going to be in that area, and I get that. But the USGA itself, the organization, and the choices they have made in recent years has made themselves center, front and center story. And to me, that is amongst many things that have and believe me, there's a list of things that I'm disappointed in. You know, you can throw on the arrogance, their lack of, you know, they're like the U.S. government. You know, they don't apologize. You know, they'll come in, they'll accuse you, they'll do this, they'll do that. You know, they'll search your house. They're not going to apologize for what they think they're doing. So, and they never do. And the smugness and the arrogance is becoming tiresome, to be quite frankly. How's that for a start? Is that a good start?
Well, I must say, you're saving me the bother of having to speak for the rest of the show, because you said everything I want to say. But yeah, the USGA, it seems every single year with the US Open, which is obviously one of golf's greatest championships, something we should really be celebrating, one of the biggest events of the game, one of the four biggest weeks of the year, and somehow, almost without fail, every single year it comes back to the USGA. They somehow become the headline makers on the Monday morning, and that's not how it should be at all. And it's happened, you know, last year at Chambers Bay, where the course, well, they played a golf course last year that didn't have any greens, really. It was defined by little dots in the fairways.
Yep.
And in the end, that was a bit of a farce. Mostly, actually, not just the golf course, which was bad enough at times, and certainly overblown and a bit unfortunate with conditions, but also the way they set the course up. But last year as well, the fact that the spectators at Chambers Bay that year could barely see anything, that was a disgrace. For a golf course that was essentially built to host the US Open, that was a shambles. And they were saved last year by the players. You know, Jordan Spieth and Johnson and Brandon Grace and Louis Westhead and all these different guys put together a great finish, and that saved the USGA from further embarrassment. And last night, you know, what happened was obviously equally contentious, and really it really killed the whole tournament. The tournament was actually bubbling up quite nicely. It was getting tight and close. There was a variety of different players in contention, all with variously interesting stories. Guys like Dustin Gomez's first major, Shane Lowry, Sergio Garcia, and even Scott Piercy. Lots of guys that had a chance to win. And after the incident happened on the 12th tee with Dustin Johnson, the last sort of 2 hours of the tournament just became it was strange. The whole atmosphere died. The place went quiet. The crowd quietened down. The players looked flat and confused. And I never thought I'd hear the day when broadcasters and television would say, "Oh, I think this putt is to tie for the lead, maybe." You know, there was so much confusion, so much up in the air. And it all seemed to me to be completely unnecessary. And again, what it has achieved is one thing, is that it made the USGA the center of attention once again. And they have this habit of doing it, and it's something that's not healthy for the game, not healthy for the US Open either. It's not healthy for their own reputation, because the players are becoming increasingly frustrated with it. I think the reaction from the players last night on Twitter, Rory, Jordan Spieth, even Tiger Woods hinted at it as well. You know, the USGA have burned a lot of bridges here with players, and it's getting worse every single year, and somebody's going to have to give eventually with this. But again, it comes back to, we'll talk about the rule itself and what happened, but I think it's, you know, the USGA created this problem for themselves for a variety of reasons, and you know, they played with fire, and when you do that, you often get burned.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, if we move on to now to exactly, we don't even have to get to the rule. I mean, listen, I even, like, the rule itself, like, I almost get it, actually. You know, like, at this point, I get it. Do I agree with it? No. But no. I'm just saying I understand it. That I even get, though I think it's ridiculous, I get the 51% of, you know, burden of proof and all that stuff. I understand it. It's smart enough to wrap my brain around the principle behind the rule, why the rule is there. I get all of that. But the fact that this is your national championship. This is your, let's face it, just like on your side of the pond, you all your most of your revenue for your organization is coming from your national championship, all right? And in your case, the international championship. But this is our. I mean, this is basically subsidizing every other championship that you provide or put on, and you cannot tell players where they stand as they come in, as they're coming down the stretch. It's not even. You know, there are no words for it. Like, absurd is not even the right word. Ridiculous is not even the right word. It's just, you know, there's just no way you can have a Super Bowl and then say that touchdown might count. I'll let you know in the fourth quarter. It shouldn't hurt your strategy as an offense or a defensive coordinator coming down in the fourth quarter. You know, like, it's just honestly, the only word I can come up with is mind-boggling. I mean, that's the only thing I just can't even that all the out of all the intelligence in that organization, no one said this is bad, and no one said, you know what, we went to the videotape. We're not going to discuss it with you. We're giving you the stroke. You should know that, and you know, have at it for the last seven holes or eight holes or whatever it is, but. Yeah. To not have to no one in your national championship, your FIFA, your World Cup championship, your Super Bowl, and the opponents not knowing the score is really lunacy. That's another word I would use.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you're right there about the fact that, you know, they left it hanging in the air. That created a real uncertainty for everybody concerned. And, you know, Fox Sports, who have paid an unbelievable amount of money to broadcast the U.S. Open in the U.S., you know, they must be wondering what they've got themselves into. You know, last year, Chambers Day was not a success in many ways. It was actually hard for people to follow the event on television. It's hard to get any definition with the ball and where it was. And then this year, you have this farce as well. So the U.S. Open has become, a lunacy. It's become a black spot on the schedule where, every year we come to it and we expect the worst because usually they deliver it to us. And this year was a real step, you know, a real step below above everything else I've ever done before. You know, you talk about course setups, Shinnecock in 04, where they lost the greens and whatnot, and that's one thing. And obviously last year's another thing. But this was something even more kind of fundamental it did beggar belief. We really had no idea what was going on in the thought process here, why it took them so long, firstly, to actually... incident happened on the fifth hole, and over an hour later, they finally let him know that he might be getting a penalty. But the thing is, as you kind of indicated there, it seemed to me that they had already made the decision in their own minds what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Why not, you know, give him the penalty right there then, and that'll be it, over with. The rule itself, I agree with what you're saying. I do think it's somewhat problematic, and to me, it's going to be a recurring issue. You know, obviously, they brought this rule in to stop players who, you know, when the ball rolls back for no reason whatsoever, you're always penalised if you've addressed the ball. That's something they've tried to change, but they've actually complicated it even further with this. And I don't think you can look at what happened in the tape and really say that who caused the ball to move or not, because in the end, that same day, Romain Wattel, the French golfer, had a similar incident happen. He actually addressed the ball, then lifted his putter up, and then 5 seconds later the ball moved, and they deemed it not to be caused by him because of that 5 second timescale. So it's very subjective, and I think that's a problem as well. It has to be very black and white. But again, I'll come back to this one, and once again, I mentioned to you before we got on to before we started recording, and that really for me is this would not have happened if the greens at Oakmont weren't as ludicrously fast as what they were. You know, for greens there, which are, you know, the sloping greens or tilted greens, and they're running at almost 15 on the stint meter. It's 14.8 was the number I've seen mentioned. And, you know, there's no friction there between the ball. Anything could cause that to move. You know, a slight gust of wind, gravity, the weight of the ball. It could be sitting on an ever so slight indentation on the green, and that eventually would cause it to move. I understand the 51% weight of evidence thing, but for me, I'm not sure how anyone can really, conclusively define if Dustin Johnson caused that ball to move. And in the end, the ruling for me was made at the time where Dustin Johnson called it. He looked over to Lee West and his caddy. Lee West confirmed that he didn't address the ball. That's fine. The rules official who was there asked him directly, did you address the ball? The answer was no. Well, that's fine. In the end, of course, that's not actually what the rule says. So there was a lack of clarity there. But for me, when you have a player, his playing partner who's keeping his score, who's essentially protecting the field for everybody else, then, and the referee who was on site there making a decision, that's what should stand. That's how it's always been. I think HD cameras and all the video highlights, that's an issue for the game to address. It has to simplify the rules, not make them more complicated. And again, with Dustin Johnson, you know, are the USGA essentially inferring that he's a liar? He's not being honest? And for me, that's what that ruling is suggesting. And that's a really dark and murky road to go down for the game. But you know, for the biggest championship the USGA run, one of the biggest events in the game, a big sporting event in the US and around the world, a real showcase for the game of golf, showpiece event, and to have the last 2 hours of it just completely ruined, it is mind-boggling. It was quite stunning to watch, incredible what unfolded. And again, you know, like I said, last year the players saved the USGA from embarrassment with Chambers Bay, and you know, there is a lot of embarrassment rightly so doing the rounds here at the USGA, but Dustin Johnson saved them from even more embarrassment. But for me, you know, the greens themselves, they're too fast. This is going to be a recurring problem going forward. We know why that's the case. The golf ball goes too far. You know, the setups are coming ever more extreme. And when you place golf courses on the edge, you know, at the same time you're placing the game on the edge. And that's what the USGA and the RNA have done here in the last 20 years. When they've overlooked the changes in equipment, you know, this year 26 players are averaging 300 yards or more off the tee on the PGA Tour. 20 years ago, the number was zero. 15 years ago, John Daly was the only player over 300 yards. And they are trying to tell us that the distance has not increased in the last 13 years. Well, they're using misleading facts to do so. And if that's the case, why are the golf courses getting longer? Why are we having a 300-yard par 3 this week? Why are we going to have a 700 par 5 next year, an 8,000-yard course in Erin Hills? You know, why is this happening? Why is the rough getting thicker? Why are the greens getting faster? Look at the old course last year. You mentioned it there with the wind at the Open. You know, that should never have happened. Why are the RNA leveling the greens out there, number 11 at the old course? Because the greens now are too fast. You know, 50 years ago, that would not have been the case. And actually, recently, Jack Nicklaus, in an interview on Golf Digest, he won the US Open at Oakmont in 62. And he said in that interview that the greens that week were running at about 8 on the stint meter. They're almost twice as fast now. That's what the problem is. The USGA and the RNA have collectively allowed the game of golf to be taken to the edge, and that is unforgivable. And that's why what happened the weekend happened, and that's why it will happen again in the years to come until they address it.
I agree 100%. They have become the custodians of the game, have become somewhat absentee landlords, and that is a great disappointment. Not only is it a disappointment, but what makes it even more insulting to my intelligence is the fact that, as you put, first of all, they made a rule that was completely problematic on the level of judgment, because then how many seconds constitutes too long? How many seconds doesn't constitute too long? Like, why was one good and why, how many, you know, where, what's the cutoff? And is there somebody with a stopwatch doing that? That's number one. Number two, you painted yourself into a corner and basically had to call Dustin Johnson a liar because you, as an organization, in your inability to face and look in the mirror, you could not call yourself out by saying the ball moved because these greens are running at a 14 and a half with a slope of 1 point whatever. So, yeah. And if you do that, well, then you indict yourself. So in protecting yourself, you then question the integrity of one of your participants and in a game in which usually we don't really question the integrity of the participants. In fact, we herald the participants because of said integrity. And so that's very disappointing in itself. The other thing was, and I got so angry there for a second, I forgot what my other point was. Oh, the other thing was that what makes it a greater farce was because when the USGA people got on TV and said, well, we had to say something because we had to protect the integrity of the competition. Like, you know, in the sense that, and my point being that they could have probably looked at this and been like, you know what? I don't see this as an issue. His ball, his club was next to it. I'm letting it go. And nobody would have questioned it. Nobody would have said boo. And instead, they made it about themselves, like, and the rules and how we're going to, you know, we're the custodians of the rules. And they said, oh, no, we have to alert the field. We have to protect the field. We may have an issue. Well, in this whole idea of protection, you know, of keeping the integrity of the field and the integrity of the competition, well, you jeopardize the integrity of the competition when you failed to rule on the issue in an expedient way. So the very competition that you're protecting, you've jeopardized already because you haven't told anybody what the ruling is. Nobody knows what they're playing for, how they're going to play. I mean, they know what they're playing for, but they don't know how they're going to go about doing it. They don't know what the score is. So this competition, the integrity of the competition that you're protecting, you have jeopardized. And nobody, and this is, you know, and you're supposed to be in charge. I don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's just a completely inexplicable whole situation. Again, I don't understand why it took them so long to, you know, look at the footage. Surely there must have somebody who's watching the footage in a cabin somewhere, and it took over an hour to let Dustin Johnson know about this. And again, I've never seen anybody, you know, penalised a shot for the ball moving when they were having a practice stroke. I know he was quite close to the ball when he was doing that, but if we're at the stage where you can get penalised for people having for practice strokes, then, you know, what has the game come to? You know, what position are we in? And again, as I say, it comes back to the course setup and the greens, and that's again an issue here. And you mentioned the USGA protecting the competition and the integrity of the event. Yeah, that is their whole, the reason for their existence is to protect, to preserve, and to promote the game of golf in the United States. And they've fallen asleep at the wheel, as have the RNA over here. And because of this collective ineptitude, you know, we're having situations like this. These are the guys who write the rules. They wrote this rule. It doesn't make much sense. It doesn't stand to any scrutiny. It's very contentious. It has to be simplified. I don't know where you could try and change it. A kind of simple solution would be, I don't know, maybe a bit like when you're on the tee, where if there was no intent to move the ball, then you replace it with no penalty. Maybe that should be a very simple black and white way to go for the game. I don't think that's going to happen, but you know, maybe that would be an option. But for me, you know, Dustin Johnson, in the end, he did not cause the ball to move. You know, no more than, you know, oxygen did, or gravity, or the weight of the ball, or just simply the fact that the greens are ridiculously fast. How they can possibly ascertain that one way or the other is that they can't possibly do that. And I know the game, I know the rule states, well, if nothing else was obviously, well, as a gust of wind wasn't there, obviously there was no wind at all, if there wasn't any wind then, something must have caused the ball to move, then why did they immediately jump to, well, we'll blame it on the player. It's obviously the player's fault. Not just the fact that, well, you know, the golf ball's precariously hanging on a bit of green here that's ridiculously fast, ridiculously slopey. It could have been on a pitch mark or something, a very minor indentation on the green that could cause the ball to move when the greens are in that condition, being so firm and fast and have no friction on them. So it's a shame what happened. It's a shame for the championship. It's a shame for everybody involved in it, the players. You know, I feel for them. You know, Dustin Johnson, who did remarkably to recover from this and won the championship in great fashion. It was a real kind of sticking the fingers up at the USGA when he made that brilliant finish on the last hole. You know, great. And I think everybody was cheering him on there. Even if you weren't a Dustin Johnson fan, everyone was right behind him. I think even the fans there in attendance at Oakmont, you could hear their support for him. Obviously, when they booed the USGA when Joe Buck brought it up in the ceremony at the end. And incidentally, what was going on with that ceremony as well? The USGA president, I think she was drunk or something. You know, she sounded like she was trying to speak for the first time in her entire life. The whole thing had a real unprofessional air to it. And the USGA is an amateur body, and of course it will bring about question of, well, should the amateurs be running a professional tournament, a professional championship? A lot of tour players feel that way, have always felt that way. Charlie Hoffman, even before the event started, commented on that the US Open's an event run by amateurs now. These guys write the rules. But in the end, it's not just, you know, they may be amateurs. These are professional people. They're intelligent people, but they're not acting like it. You know, every single year we get to the US Open, they do things that are just stupid. The course setups are stupid. They're putting the game on the edge. They're putting the golf courses on the edge. and they're putting the players out, and they always put it on the players. Well, you know, if the players are struggling on the golf course, well, it's clearly their fault, not the course. If there's a bad ruling here, well, it's Dustin Johnson's fault, not ours. And that seems to be the thing, is there's a real lack of responsibility being taken by the USGA. You know, Mike Davis has been, you know, has he run out of the country or something in the past 24 hours? You know, he has disappeared. There's been virtually complete silence, apart from those two guys who went onto the Golf Channel last night who were completely skewered by Brandel Chambly, and also the guys who went on Fox as well. There's been a real silence from the USGA about this. They've got to stand up and take responsibility, because they are the governing body of the game of golf in the US. Well, you know, guys, it's time to start up and get governing. Time to do your job. These guys have fallen asleep at the wheel for years now. They're denying that. They're denying reality. They're misleading everybody else with their statements and their reports about the distance and so on. And this year was a result of that. And, you know, it falls at their feet every single time, and they've got to do something about it. But you know what? Maybe this moment here is going to lead to some sort of change, whether it be in the rules, but it's, again, it comes back to the distance, the ball. That's what's caused this in the end, the course setups. The USGA for years now have defied reality. They've tried to push courses further to the edge, and when you do that, you're going to tip over eventually. And yesterday, they tipped over. Last year, they tipped over the edge. And you know what? Next year, they'll probably do the same again.
And let's not even, I mean, if we really want to pile it on, and I'm not meaning to, it's not my intention to pile it on, but it does beg the question, would they have done this if this was Tiger Woods? Would they have done this? would they have done this if this was Jordan Spieth? Would they have done this if this was Rory McIlroy? Now, they might be, not only are they lucky that the fact that Dustin Johnson saved them with his excellent play down the stretch, but they're lucky they didn't get a Rory McIlroy or Jordan Spieth or Tiger Woods, because they could have held that whole contest hostage until they sorted it out. And, you know, Justin, and I don't mean this, I mean, Dustin is not, listen, we joke around, he's a nice, you know, I have no problems with him. I know he's not, like, you know, there's a big difference between him and, let's say, Jeff Ogilvy. All right, I mean, one is a much more insightful, articulate,
cerebral,
you know, more cerebral. And that goes to another whole nother thing about whether this happened to the right person, in terms of, because he was able to, you know, keep everything at bay. But that's a whole that's a different argument. My point is, someone who was, you know, might have intellectually engaged in this whole thing might have been like, you know, with Stevie Williams, if it was, or Adam Scott and Stevie Williams, you think Stevie Williams would have said, Adam, we're not moving until we know exactly what's going on? He would have made a stink. And so they were lucky on many accounts. And I have to think that the people that were involved had a little something to do with how they behaved.
Well, that's a great point. And certainly if I was in Dustin Johnson's position, a number of guys have mentioned it on Twitter. And actually, Ewan Murray, who commentates for Sky Sports, former European Tour player, he said as well, you know, if he was in that situation, he would have stopped playing and just said, right, bring out an iPad here, we'll sort this out right now and get on with it and get a championship. For everybody's sake, not just his own, for Shane Lowry's sake, for Scott Piercy, Sergio Garcia, everybody's sake, let's get this done, let's end the uncertainty, because that uncertainty is a black mark on this championship. It completely ruined it. You know, even though it had a great finish and a good champion, and Dustin Johnson, you know, someone who, he's had his ups and downs, in the majors especially, but he's come through them all. He's come through what happened a year or two ago now with the absence he had from the game. We all know what that was really about, but we'll leave it at that. But he's come back from that a stronger person, a better person. Everyone's talked about that. You know, he's had a son, of course, young Tatum, and everyone who's close to us has talked about how that's completely changed his outlook on life, his whole attitude. He's become a more mature, grounded individual. And I'm happy to see him become a major champion. He has a tremendous skill level, and a major is what he fits that level of a player he is. And actually, he's perhaps underachieved in that in the majors in the past. But now he's got one, may open the floodgates. But for the that moment itself, yes, I think a stronger player mentally, psychologically, maybe more of a cerebral player would have said, "Hold on, wait a minute here," and would have, you know, stopped and would have said, "Right, we'll deal with this right now for everybody's sake." And again, you're right there, that would have caused an even bigger embarrassment to the USGA if the whole championship literally stopped
Yeah, because then you wouldn't have they wouldn't have finished on time.
It almost did stop anyway, because for me the championship completely changed after the 12T for Dustin. You know, the atmosphere changed, the players changed, everybody was actually kind of building. Every major should kind of build up slowly. You look like a great piece of music or a great movie, you should build up towards the end, and then you should have a great finale. This one here built up and bubbled up nicely, and then it just went flat at the end. And I haven't seen a major as flat as that possibly ever. And that's a shame, because the event itself was built up so well, and it's going to be a fascinating back nine, so many great stories. And the USGA have taken that from us, and they've taken that opportunity from the players as well. And we should be talking about Dustin Johnson winning the championship, great event, the performances of Sergio Garcia, Shane Lowry, Andrew Landry, a great run from him, what a story that was. We should be talking about those things. But again, with the US Open, we touched on it at the start of the podcast, but again, somehow these guys, the USGA, is it deliberate? Is there an ego thing behind them? I don't know, but we can only speculate about this. But in the end, somehow the story always ends up back at them, and that is a shame for the game. It really is.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure there's, I haven't, I watched everything last night, and I didn't look at anything today. I was, hard at work, obviously, and wasn't able to really get a chance to look at anything in the aftermath. I mean, I saw everything I needed to see last night, and I'm not sure, I don't know if there's anything left to be said about it. I think I just needed to, purge a little bit, and now I've had my... I've gotten rid of it now, and I feel, I've had my
good... You feel better, do you? Do you feel better?
I've had my good cry now. And so...
that's why I'm here. I'm your friend across the pond. If you need to vent, if you need to shout your frustrations about the game of golf, I'm here to listen to you.
Well,
I'm your therapist.
Well, what bothers me, the thing is, the frustration is, and what is, lining... My frustration is the fact that I just don't think anything is going to change, and I don't think anything's gonna.
That's really
what it comes down to. No one's gonna, maybe 5 years from now, just like the bake out at Shinnecock. It wasn't until like many years later that they finally said it was. And I'm not even sure they ever said it. They said we got too close to the edge. Maybe that's all they've said. I'm not sure they've ever really said, "Oh, we totally screwed that up." And so they're never gonna apologize really for it. They're never gonna, this just is what it is, and I don't see anything changing. That's the part of it that bothers me, is that there's not, sometimes I know we want heads to roll all too quickly, but at the same time, how long is the USGA going to be the custodian of the rules of the game and conduct the championship in this manner, in this embarrassing manner? How long are they going to be able to do that? How long are they going to be allowed to do that?
I think in the end, it's going to be as long as the players themselves allow them to do it. And I think it is almost reaching breaking point. Last year at Chambers Bay, that was a big thing. The players were not happy with that at all. They hated the course conditioning, they hated the golf course, and in the end, obviously, as I say earlier on, the finish there kind of retrieved the championship from being a total disaster, but it was, the spectator thing with her start was a shamble. That was disgraceful, actually. People pay good money to go and watch the US Open there in Seattle, Washington for the first time, and they could barely see anything. That was a disgrace.
And they end up taking them out of the rotation.
The reaction from the players, the leading players, Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, Tiger Woods comment on a rules farce, as he called it. Of course, Tiger's not been he's had his moments as well with the rules. Don't forget Augusta 3 years ago when that happened there. That was a moment where
sure.
I think you brought up Tiger being, would the USGA do it with Tiger? Well, Augusta National there, they slightly bended the situation.
They found a way to keep him in the competition.
They did, and for me that comes back to Fred Ridley, who is the head of rules at Augusta National. He wants to be... The chairman of Augusta National Golf Club, and he could not have that on his resume, really, to be the guy that disqualified Tiger Woods from the Masters when he was in contention. And maybe the USG would do a similar thing, I'm not sure. But I think the players here are becoming increasingly frustrated with the whole thing. You know, Jordan Spieth was perhaps most telling of all when he said that, you know, last year they were saved embarrassment, but this year, you know, they should not be allowed to be saved the embarrassment. We should still talk about this. This is still to be made a big issue going forward. And I think many players, you know, obviously the PGA Tour itself doesn't run a major championship. You know, it always wanted to. The Players' Championship is its sort of version, if you like. And, you know, the players themselves, you know, you see some guys this year, you know, lower-ranked players, admittedly, who didn't even enter the US Open qualifying this year because they don't like it. They don't like the golf course setups and whatever else. And people can say, well, oh, they're whining or the this and that. But in the end, it's stupid. You know, when you see a golf course that is taken to the brink, like, Oakmont is a fantastic golf course. It's a great golf course. It's a brilliant design. But I think, in the end, you know, golf and Oakmont itself can be so much better than what we see when the US Open goes there. It's going back there in 2025, and you know, tell you what, how far the guys will be hitting the ball then. And you know, I would not be surprised if they stick a green on the Pennsylvania Turnpike or whatever it's called in the middle of the course, because it's getting that ridiculous. Where look at the old course of St Andrews now, where we literally now have there championship tees that aren't even on the golf course. You know, what is this madness? The game is lost. You know, these guys, I mean, are staying the bus as the game of golf, and they've lost control. The wheels have fallen off. The game has been taken right to the edge. It's falling off. We've just reached the cusp of that. And it's got to give eventually. And for me, you know, we've just about reached breaking point. What happened yesterday was a result, for my mind, directly of this, with the technology, with the lack of with the oversight from the USGA and the RNA. Something has got to change. Otherwise, we'll be talking about this sort of incident happening more regularly, more often going forward, and that's not good for anybody, the game itself, the players, the fans watching. You know, could you imagine if, you know, if Dustin Johnson somehow, it was a tie with him and Shane Lowry or whoever else, and he lost the championship as a result of this. You know, it was bad enough what happened at Whistling Straits, which of course is a cartoon golf course with its Mickey Mouse bunkers everywhere, you know, which aren't even bunkers, but they claim that, you know, that was a disaster 6 years ago. You know, this would have been even worse than that. And it's becoming infuriating where, you know, any other sport, you mentioned at the start of the show there, but any sport, you know, a soccer match where was the ball over the line or not? Well, we'll find out after the game. You know, what kind of way is that to conduct a sport? You make a decision there and now, whether it's correct or incorrect, then you deal with it. But for me, it's this whole retrospective looking back at things and then trying to change things, then the uncertainty of that and how that affects the tournament itself, you know, that is unforgivable. And for me, going forward, if anything is going to change, it might just be the procedures that the USGA utilise in terms of informing players and whatnot when they have a rule situation. Maybe that will change, but you know, there are far bigger issues to change as well. And like you, I don't think anything is going to change, you know, and meaningfully wise going forward for any time soon, which is a shame because the game, I say a few times tonight so far, but the game has been taken to the edge, or it's been sort of blissfully, willingly taken to the edge by these people who are there to protect the game. They've failed at their job, and we're now seeing the repercussions of that.
Absolutely. Let's move on to something a little more positive, something that will keep me from doing any harm to myself later on. Now, seriously, first of all, I wanted to get your take on Shane Lowry. I remember I was watching the Golf Channel earlier in the day, or it might have been the live from the night before. I can't remember. And someone said, you know, he won the amateur when he won the Irish Open when he was an amateur. He's ready for the biggest stage. I mean, quite frankly, this is not the Irish amateur. The Irish Open. I get like the comparison, but no, that maybe it was part of the. My point being that the Golf Channel person, I don't remember who it was, seemed to say that moment prepared him for what he was about to face. And my feeling, the first thing that came to my mind was not even close. That first of all, in the sense that yes, it was a big event, but first of all, how long ago was that? Number one.
7 years ago.
How long?
7 years. 2009.
Right, so that's almost a decade ago, okay, number one. And number two, I mean, this is the Irish Open is a big deal to him, but this is a major championship. I'm not saying that it's sort of like a major for him. Yes. But is it a major? No. So to that would be like saying the Irish Open was winning the Irish Open is like winning it was like winning the Open Championship. It's not. It's not. Like it's a, yeah. very important to them. Don't get me wrong, but it's not the same. And so, but I was, you know, I like him. I was rooting, you know, I wasn't rooting against him or rooting for him or whatever. Or let me just say, I would be happy just with as happy with a Lowry win as I am. If, you know, let's say sans a rules debacle, I would have been happy with any of the, you know, people at the leader, at the top of the leaderboard at the start of the day. And so, but just your thoughts on Shane Lowry in the last day.
Well, I'm a big fan of Shane Lowry as a player and as an individual. I think he's got a fantastic attitude. He's got a great feel of his game. His short game is fantastic. It was brilliant in the first 3 days there. And his passing was excellent. You know, his long game was also very good too, and he gave himself the opportunities, but he always capitalized on them. You know, he had a birdie chance, he took it. When he had to make a big par save, he did it as well, and that's where he had the four-shot lead. But I think Shane, you know, he won the Irish Open 7 years ago as an amateur, which was obviously a tremendous achievement. Last year, he won the Bridgestone Invitational in Ohio, just obviously 100 miles away from Pennsylvania, and so he has got a big-time experience now. He's certainly elevated himself into being a top-tier player. And, of course, he played very well at the US Open last year. And he's certainly someone who's knocking at the door now in big events. But leading a major championship by four shots is a different thing entirely to what he's had before. And it seemed to me that he was extremely nervous. And I know that's natural, but he gave more away than most people do. He had an interview on Sky Sports here in the UK before he had to play. I spoke about being nervous, and he looked nervous. He was giving so much away, and I think he was very edgy going on the first tee. And I don't think he was helped at all by playing with Andrew Landry, who also struggled. He really struggled, and I think they almost dragged each other down. And then, and again, of course, look at Dustin Johnson playing with Lee Westwood, who had the worst day of anybody on the course.
Right.
Dustin was able to blank that out and keep focused and obviously play his game brilliantly. But Dustin's obviously a different kind of character. As I've touched on before, he's not the most cerebral player. That's both probably his weakness and his strength, where he doesn't think about things too much. Nothing on the outside really phases him, and that's a great asset to have in golf. But Shane Lowry, I think, looked a little bit overawed. He spoke about the day before how he's actually visualised holding the US Open trophy. That's how he does things. He's someone who watches leaderboards. He likes to know where he stands. He likes to be aware of the situation. And maybe he was too aware of the situation on Sunday at the US Open. And it's a shame because he's someone who, you know, there's a lot to admire about Shane in so many ways, and he's a fantastic player, and he will certainly continue to grow and to be a fantastic player moving forward. He'll certainly become more consistent, he gets more comfortable in that limelight. Look at Dustin Johnson, the amount of near misses he's had in majors. You know, every great player's had their moment when they've lost out in a major. You know, Jack Nicklaus finished second 19 times in majors. You know, it happened to everybody at some point, they've lost a major. And obviously, Shane will feel really hard about it right now. He actually came back over immediately from America to do a corporate day in Dublin, in Ireland. And so he's still, he'll take the next week or two off, come back, go and head into the Open Championship. He'll be defending his Bridgestone title 2 weeks prior at Akron. So he'll be coming back for that. But you know, Shane is someone I like very much. I enjoy his game. I think he's very good. But I think maybe the pressure did get to him, I think, in the end. And who knows what influence the situation with Dustin Johnson had on him as well. He seemed to lose focus at that point, as did a lot of guys in the course. But that said, he was struggling a little bit before that as well. I think he was dragged down by Landry. A particular moment would be on the second hole where Landry hit his second shot through the green. And what did Lowry do? Hit it short. You know, he seemed to react to what Landry was doing. Landry was, generally speaking, hitting the ball into the green as before he was. He's not as long a hitter. And I think that was telling in the end. You know, if people were saying, well, was it a benefit to have Dustin Johnson not in the final pairing for Shane Lowry? Would that have been easier pairing for Shane to play with someone like Landry and not Dustin? Well, I disagree. I think that would actually been easier for him to play with Dustin. I think it's actually better for Dustin not to be in the final pairing. But you know, for Shane, hopefully he'll bounce back from this soon. But you know, he finished second in the US Open. If he's going to win the Ryder Cup team, he's made a lot of money, a lot of ranking points. He'll be back going forward. But and hopefully for him, he doesn't get too hard on himself. But He's got a great attitude. He's got a sporting family around him. His dad was a great Gaelic football player, which is a big sport in Ireland. So he's got a great experience, kind of good, relaxed guys around him. And I'm sure Shane will be fine going forward. But obviously today, it will certainly hurt.
Yeah, he's a top guy. I really like him a lot. To your point, I think the only thing I would say, I agree. You know, it was weird. On one hand, Westwood did not bring DJ down, but Landry seemed to bring Lowry down. And I think the difference in those two pairings is the fact that DJ almost seems like a horse had, you know, like he was whipping that horse, in the sense that he had been down this road a couple of times now. He almost did not want to be denied. And he was like a horse he was like Seabiscuit, right? Coming down the stretch, and he kind of just didn't want to, you know, not that no one was going to stop him, but he had just had his blinders on and he was full go, and everything seemed to be, and certainly it's easy to say in retrospect, but everything seemed to be just a speed bump along the way, because he seemed, ultra focused, hyper focused, if you will, on what he was going to do. So it really didn't matter what anybody around him would have given. You know, I'm not sure he would have noticed if Westwood was walking around with his shirt off. I'm not sure he would have even, you know, recognized that, to be honest with you. He was just sort of so locked into what he was doing, and you could say locked in, you could say clueless, however you want to say it. I just think that was the difference. He just seemed, you know, maybe I'm projecting how I hope he would feel, that, you know, no one's going to take this from me. Not the USGA, not the rules of golf. Nothing is going to, nobody, not Westwood, not Lowry. Maybe I'm projecting how I wanted him to feel, but he just seemed to act like that. And which brings me to my last point of the day. I was really gutted for Lee Westwood, because he is, the guy is just the ultimate professional. I don't know how many times he had to watch, you know, wait and shake hands with Phil after he hugged his wife and kids. He had to wait for Dustin Johnson to hug hug his wife and kids. I know it's happened before, and I can't remember.
And Danny Willett as well.
Danny Willett, right, exactly. Danny Willett, he had to wait for that. The guy is might be my favorite golfer. You know, I'm a big fan, Phil fan, but
yeah.
I really was gutted for Lee Westwood. I've gotten to that point where I might be as big as a Lee Westwood fan as I am a Phil fan, because the guy is nothing but has endured heartache after heartache. I'm not going to say collapse after collapse, but maybe a few of them have been. But he's handled it nothing but class and professionalism. I have to hand it to the guy. He is, for lack of a better word, the guy is just awesome.
Yeah, and actually, he and Billy Foster are the same. And there were moments on Sunday during the final round where, towards the end, where Billy Foster and Dustin were given Dustin some kind of encouragement, you know, a little tap on the shoulder here or there, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
Billy Foster said it himself since, that they both knew what happened on 5 and then 12, you know, that was wrong. And obviously they had no chance to win from that point, so they supported Dustin. Much like the Masters, where towards the end when Lee kind of fell out of it, you know, look at when Danny Willett played that brilliant chip shot on 17 at Augusta, you know, Billy Foster gives him the thumbs up, and you know that's the kind of guys they are. You know, that's who they are, and that's what you got to admire that. And Lee Westwood, if somebody you could hand pick to have a major championship, it would be him, for so many reasons. One, because he's obviously been a fantastic player now for 20 years, former world number one, had so many chances, but also the way he conducts himself, as you say, he's the ultimate professional in every single aspect. And also, as an aside, even bigger reason to support him now and root for him is actually the fact that he actually lives in Scotland these days. He's a resident in Edinburgh, so there you go.
Oh, are you kidding me?
Yeah, there you are.
How long is it till you're sharing a pint with him?
Well, I don't know. Well, Lee, if you're listening, I'm up for it anytime. Just give me a call.
All right. I think we've carried on quite a bit. I think we've probably used up our the attention span of our listenership in terms of how long we want to go with a podcast. This might be. I think people are going to have to. This is a to work and from work kind of a podcast, but quite frankly, there was a lot to digest. There was a lot to sort through, and a lot of feelings to be mended here on both sides of the pond, if you will.
But Andy, you know what? You know, you mentioned the feelings to be mended. Well, you know, after talking to you now for the last 45 minutes, I feel better. I really do.
Well, like you said earlier, you know, I'm here for you as much as you're here there for me.
I really appreciate that. And hopefully we'll be back more regularly so yes. we can have these therapy sessions more often.
Yes. Unfortunately, life does get in the way of these of these wonderful exchanges between the two of us. And I'm sure we will get on a regularly scheduled program. We have a lot. I'm glad the listenership was a little wanting. As you know, in the entertainment business, we want to keep people wanting. Just remind them that we have a very congested summer of golf coming with the Open Championship, the PGA, the Olympics. Try not to get Zika in between now and then. And
I'll do my best.
Do your best. Stay away from those mosquitoes. And so we have plenty of golf ahead of us, but it's always fun and nice to be missed. Remember we've got plenty of golf to talk about, and there'll be plenty of Anthony and Kieran On Par podcasts to come.
Excellent.
How's that sound?
That sounds great to me.
Always a pleasure. I'm going to, we'll leave it at that, and hopefully we will speak on a more, on a much more positive note regarding the governing bodies of our sport. How's that?
Hopefully. Well, put it this way, the Open Championship, surely the RDA can't mess that up. Surely.
Let's hope that. All right. Thanks, Kieran. We'll talk soon.
Cheers, Anthony.
Cheers.